on page 301, and we are in part two, fourth story of part two. And they stopped in time is the title to that section. So let's get going, and we'll see where this leads us. Physician, heal thyself. Psychiatrist and surgeon, he had lost his way until he realized that God, not he, was the great healer. This, of course, is the story of Dr. Earl Marsh, and his date of sobriety is June 15th, 1953, which makes this an addition to the big book for the second edition. And what I think is interesting about that would then mean he would only have about a year or a year and a half when he's writing this. And I think that's fairly significant. But let's get going before we go any further into his story. I am a physician licensed to practice in a Western state. I am also an alcoholic. In two ways, I may be a little different from other alcoholics. First, we all hear at AA meetings about those who have lost everything, those who have been in jail, those who have been in prison, those who have lost their families, those who have lost their income. I never lost any of it. I never was on Skid Row. I made more money in the last year of my drinking than I made in my whole life. My wife never hinted that she would leave me. Everything that I touched from grammar school on was successful. I was president of my grammar school student body. I was president of all my classes in high school. And in my last year, I was president of that student body. I was president of each class in the university and the president of that student body. I was voted the man most likely to succeed. The same thing occurred in medical school. I belong to more medical societies and honor societies than men 10 to 20 years my senior. Mine was the Skid Row of success. The physical Skid Row in any city is miserable. The Skid Row of success is just as miserable. So let's just stop there for a second. And Rob's put up an early picture of Dr. Earl Marsh. And he references the Western state in that first line, and we know that that's California. We also know what city it was practicing in. And even if we didn't know that, we probably, you know, could glean that from the writing with his number of references to Skid Row. But it is San Francisco, so he practiced in San Francisco. Couple of other little notes. He was born in Omaha, Nebraska in 1911, and he lived to the ripe old age of 91. So 1911 to 2003, that gives him 49 years of sobriety, continuous sobriety. From the moment he talks in this story of coming into the program, he had no slips. Again, another significant point. And he moved from Omaha to San Francisco at age 10. And when he did get to San Francisco at age 15, he had his first drink, and it was wine. And knowing his birth date, 1911 plus 15 means here's another guy that was drinking during Prohibition. That means his drinking started in 1926. And also he goes into a description of that drinking event in one of the talks that he does, not in tonight's reading, but one of the talks that he does in which he got very drunk first time out of the gate. And something we hear in many alcoholic stories. And then the final thing I'll just give reference to, and again, not mentioned in the reading tonight, but prescription drugs are in his story. I'm sure he can prescribe to himself, so that's not a good thing. Okay, so he told us why he thinks he may be different from the alcoholic, the typical alcoholic, and that being that he was so successful in the early part of his life, all the way up through graduation from med school, and ultimately all these societies he belonged to. So he was, you know, basically a top of the class kind of guy. And now he's going to tell us the second way he thinks he may be different. The second way in which perhaps I may differ from some other alcoholics is this. Many alcoholics state that they don't particularly like the taste of alcohol, but that they liked the effect. I loved alcohol. I used to like to get it on my fingers so I could lick them and get another taste. I had a lot of fun drinking. I enjoyed it immensely. And then one ill-defined day, one day that I can't recall, I stepped across the line that alcoholics know so well. And from that day on, drinking was miserable. When a few drinks made me feel good before I went over that line, those same drinks now made me wretched. In an attempt to get over that feeling, there was a quick onslaught of a greater number of drinks, and then all was lost. Alcohol failed to serve the purpose. On the last day I was drinking, I went to see a friend who had had a good deal of trouble with alcohol and whose wife had left him a number of times. He had come back, however, and he was on this program. In my stupid way, I went up to see him with the idea in the back of my mind that I would investigate Alcoholics Anonymous from a medical standpoint. Deep in my heart was the feeling that maybe I could get some help here. This friend gave me a pamphlet, and I took it home, and I had my wife read it to me. There were two sentences in it that struck me. One said, "Don't feel that you are a martyr because you stopped drinking." And this hit me between the eyes. The second one said, "Don't feel that you stopped drinking for anyone other than yourself." And this hit me between the eyes. After my wife had read this to me, I said to her, as I had said many times in desperation, "I have got to do something." She's a good-natured soul and said, "I wouldn't worry about it. Probably something will happen." And then we went up the side of a hill where we have a little barbecue area to make up the fire for the barbecue. And on the way up, I thought to myself, "I'll go back down to the kitchen and refill this drink." And just then, something did happen. The thought came to me, "This is the last one." I was well into the second fifth by this time. And as that thought came to me, it was as though someone had reached down and taken a heavy overcoat off my shoulders, for that was the last one. Wow. From merely reading a pamphlet, from these two statements in the pamphlet that he recalls afterwards, it has this major impact to him that I would call a spiritual experience. Although he's not speaking of that, he's not speaking of a deity, this idea that this thought comes to him and this feeling he gets from it of this weight just being removed from his body, I believe is a spiritual experience. But now let's see where he goes. About 2 days later, I was called by a friend of mine from Nevada City. He's a brother of my wife's closest friend. He said, "Earl," and I said, "Yes." He said, "I'm an alcoholic. What do I do?" And I gave him some idea of what you do. And so I made my first 12-step call before I ever came into the program. The satisfaction I got from giving him a little of what I had read in those pamphlets, now plural, far surpassed any feeling that I had ever had before in helping patients. Now, mind you, he's a surgeon, and he's saying that he's getting a better feeling, a better connection out of this conversation via the phone. His 12-step call is via the phone. So it's a significant thing, I think. So I decided that I would go to my first meeting. I was introduced as a psychiatrist. So remember, he had that phone call before he ever went to a meeting. I belong to I belong to the American Psychiatric Society, but I don't practice psychiatry as such. I am a surgeon. Specifically, he's a gynecological, gynecological surgeon, obstetrics. That's his branch of medicine. As someone in AA said to me once upon a time, there is nothing worse than a confused psychiatrist. Again, he doesn't practice psychiatry. He's a trained psychiatrist, but his gig is surgeon. I will never forget the first meeting that I attended. There were five people present, including me. At one end of the table sat our community butcher. At the other side of the table sat one of the carpenters in our community. And at the farther end of the table sat the man who ran the bakery, while on one side sat my friend who was a mechanic. So what did he just say there? Butcher, carpenter, baker, mechanic. And he's a surgeon. So he's wondering, like, what the hell is going on here? I recall as I walked into that meeting saying to myself, here I am, a fellow of the American College of Surgeons, a fellow of the International College of Surgeons, a diplomat of one of the great specialty boards in these United States, a member of the American Psychiatric Society, and I have to go to the butcher, the baker, and the carpenter to help make a man out of me. And he does a talk, and Rob just put up a great picture. In 1953, let me say, that picture that you're looking at right now is from 1953, and it's the building of the church that he's referring to right here. In one of his talks, he talks about the Tuesday night meeting, so I did a little back digging on it. That meeting still is in operation pre-COVID. It meets at 7 o'clock on Tuesdays. It's in Mill Valley, and it's at 410 Sycamore Ave. And that first picture, it's a United Methodist Church, as you obviously see there. That church, that picture there, is being built in 1953. So I think, you know, maybe there was a temp building and they ended up in this building, but certainly he attended, you know, the finished product there at some point, you know, 1954, 55 or whatever. That was going to end up being a key meeting to him. And the name of that church is the Mount Tamal Pais, Tamalpais, United Methodist Church. So, yeah. And in one of his talks also, just to refer back to those guys for a second, he refers to his friend as a self-styled inventor. But I don't think it makes the point as well as calling him a mechanic, because then all of the other positions that he's listed there are all blue collar. You could get some sort of, you know, grandiose idea of an inventor. But I think calling him a mechanic was on purpose. You know what I mean? It was like, yeah, off the four blue collar positions I just listed. So that I think is pretty cool. All right. So that's his experience when he walks into that first meeting. He's already done what he's called the first 12-step call via the phone. Now he says, something else happened to me. Something else happened to me. This was such a new thought. What was a new thought? This was such a new thought that I got all sorts of books on higher powers. And I put a Bible by my bedside, and I put a Bible in my car. It is still there. And I put a Bible in my locker at the hospital, and I put a Bible in my desk, and I put a big book by my nightstand, and I put a 12 steps and 12 traditions in my locker at the hospital. And I got books by Emmett Fox, and I got books by God knows who. And I got to reading all these things. And the first thing you know, I was lifted right out of the AA group. And I floated higher and higher and even higher until I was way up on a pink cloud, which is known as Pink Seven. And I felt miserable again. So I thought to myself, I might just as well be drunk as feel like this. So I had not heard obviously pink clouds we hear about. I had never heard Pink Seven. And I looked it up, couldn't get like real definitive statement on it. There was one guy's sort of opinion of, you know, how we would say seventh heaven. It's the highest in the vision of heaven. The pink cloud, pink seven would be the highest pink cloud. So pretty cool. Here we go. I went to Clark, the community butcher, and I said, Clark, what is the matter with me? I don't feel right. I have been on this program for 3 months and I feel terrible. And he said, Earl, why don't you come on over and let me talk to you for a minute? So he got me a cup of coffee and a piece of cake and sat me down and said, why, there's nothing wrong with you. You've been sober for 3 months, been working hard. You've been doing all right. But then he said, let me say something to you. We have here in this community an organization that helps people, and this organization is known as Alcoholics Anonymous. Why don't you join it? I said, what do you think I've been doing? Well, he said, you've been sober, but you've been floating way up on a cloud somewhere. Why don't you go home and get the big book and open it at page 58 and see what it says? So I did. I got the big book and I read it. And this is what it said. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. The word thoroughly rang a bell. And then it went on to say, half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. And the last sentence was, we asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Complete abandon. Half measures availed us nothing. Thoroughly followed our path. Completely give themselves to this simple program. Rang in my swelled head. So what are we seeing there? We're seeing he's reading from How It Works. He's picking out some of the key meat of the writing. And what is that the counterbalance to? That's the counterbalance to what we read over on the other page where he said something else happened. He thought he was going to figure out this whole higher powers thing by reading it, by studying it, the same way he went through med school, the same way any intellectual would approach this thing on first pass. But he was still miserable, restless, irritable, discontented, and he thought he was doing the gig because he had 11 Bibles and that he read everything that Emmett Fox, and in one of his talks, he says that, and I didn't look it up, but he says Emmett Fox had 57 books. He says, I read every of them. And I believe him just based on this. This is the sort of personality that would think that you could like research this thing. It's not an experience. It's something you learn. That's how he's coming. So this is the revelation for him of actually doing something, that it's not talk, that it's action. What else do I want to say? Oh, I wanted to identify just a little. It's a little side thing, but it does tell us in the reading there, Clark is the butcher. Shorty was the carpenter. Vern was the baker. And his friend, the mechanic, is Harry H. And I just thought that's really neat. Now, the other thing I wanted to reference is two mentions of it so far. And I don't think there's another one, but on the program. That's an older description of how we would say we're in AA, we're in the program. Back in the day, it was much more likely to be referred to as being on the program, like on a diet, prescribed, I'm on that prescription. So it would be interesting to figure out where that sort of morphed a bit, but cool stuff. Okay, here we are, middle of the page, 305. Years earlier, I had gone into psychoanalysis to get relief. I spent 5.5 years in psychoanalysis and proceeded to become a drunk. I don't mean that in any sense as a derogatory statement about psychotherapy. It's a very great tool, not too potent, but a great tool. I would do it again. And the thing that popped out to me there was in one of his talks, he goes into a little bit more depth of that. And he says that he went every day for 5 years, 5 days a week for 5 years to psychotherapy. And I said, like, wow, that could that how did that work out? Let me think. Let me see how that would work out mathematically. And it sort of it dawned on me, you know, if he's reporting to a hospital every day as a surgeon, if he's going into the hospital every day, he could have a relationship with a psychiatrist there. And they meet every day at 9 a.m. You know, I could see that happening. So he took it very seriously, totally an alcoholic approach to psychotherapy, if you ask me. All right, let's keep going. I tried every gimmick that there was to get some peace of mind, but it was not until I was brought to my alcoholic knees, when I was brought to a group in my own community with the butcher, the baker, the carpenter, and the mechanic, who were able to give me the 12 steps, that I was finally given some semblance of an answer to the last half of the first step, which is, of course, unmanageability. So after taking the first half of the first step, powerlessness, and very gingerly admitting myself to Alcoholics Anonymous, something happened. Look at his choice of words there. It's a hospital admission. Admitting myself to Alcoholics Anonymous, turning one over to the doctor, you know, the 12 steps of the doctor here. And then I thought to myself, imagine an alcoholic admitting anything, but I made my admission just the same. The third step said, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Now they asked us to make a decision. We've got to turn the whole business over to some joker we can't even see. And this chokes the alcoholic. Here, he is powerless, unmanageable, in the grip of something bigger than he is. And he's got to turn the whole business over to someone else. It fills the alcoholic with rage. We are great people. We can handle anything. And so one gets to thinking to oneself, who is this God? Who is this fellow we are supposed to turn everything over to? What can he do for us that we can't do for ourselves? Well, I don't know who he is, but I've got my own idea. For myself, I have an absolute proof of the existence of God. And this is, Carl Jung did a great interview one time where the interviewer said, do you believe in God? And he said, I know God. He knew the existence of God from seeing various examples. Now watch the example that makes Dr. Marsh say this. Watch. I was sitting in my office one time after I had operated on a woman. It had been a long 4 or 5 hour operation, a large surgical procedure. And she was on her 9th or 10th post-operative day. She was doing fine. She was up and around. And that day her husband phoned me and said, doctor, thanks very much for curing my wife. And I thanked him for his felicitations, and he hung up. And then I scratched my head and I said to myself, what a fantastic thing for a man to say that I cured his wife. Here I am down at my office behind my desk, and there she is out at the hospital. I'm not even there. And if I was there, the only thing I could do would be to give her moral support. And yet he thanks me for curing his wife. I thought to myself, what is curing that woman? Yes, I put in those stitches. The great boss had given me diagnostic and surgical talent, and he has loaned it to me to use for the rest of my life. It doesn't belong to me. He has loaned it to me, and I did my job, but that ended 9 days ago. What healed those tissues that I closed? I didn't. This, to me, is the proof of the existence of a somethingness, capital S, greater than I am. I couldn't practice medicine without the great physician. All I do in a very simple way is to help him cure my patients. That's a spiritual experience. That's a second spiritual experience that he's come up in 3 pages. Shortly after I was starting to work on the program, I realized that I was not a good father. I wasn't a good husband, but oh, I was a good provider. I never robbed my family of anything. I gave them everything except the greatest thing in the world, and that is peace of mind. So I went to my wife and I asked her if there wasn't something that she and I could do to somehow get together. And she turned on her heel and looked me squarely in the eye and said, "You don't care anything about my problem." And I could have smacked her, but I said to myself, "Grab onto your serenity." She left and I sat down and I crossed my hands and I looked up and I said, "For God's sake, help me." And then a silly, simple thought came to me. I didn't know anything about being a father. I didn't know how to come home and work weekends like other husbands. I didn't know how to entertain my family. But I remembered that every night after dinner, my wife would get up and do the dishes. Well, I could do the dishes. So I went to her and I said, "There's only one thing I want in my whole life, and I don't want any combination. I don't want any credit. I don't want anything from you or Janie for the rest of your life, except one thing, and that is the opportunity to do anything you want always. And I would like to start off by doing the dishes. And now I'm doing the darn dishes every night." So to me, that sounds like the first line of that paragraph. It sounds like she left, he's angry. He switches into a more spiritual, it first says, I could have smacked her. He's trying to switch into a more, you know, it's almost an 11 step pause when agitated. Grab onto your serenity. He crosses his hand in prayer and he wants and needs God. He wants and needs God and verbally says out, "For God's sake, help me." The dependence on HP, and the intuitive thought comes to him how to deal with this. He's doing right here a ninth step. Right here, he's doing a ninth step. He went to her. She said, "You're full of baloney." He's going to lose his cool. He reins himself back in and offers to do the dishes. And it's a long-term commitment. So I thought that was a nice imagery. Back to our reading. Doctors have been notoriously unsuccessful in helping alcoholics. They have contributed fantastic amounts of time and work to our problem, but they aren't able, it seems, to arrest either your alcoholism or mine. And the clergy have tried hard to help us, but we haven't been helped. And the psychiatrist has had thousands of couches, and has put you and me on them many, many times, but he hasn't helped us very much, though he has tried hard. And we owe the clergy and the doctor and the psychiatrist a deep debt of gratitude, but they haven't helped our alcoholism, except in a few rare, in a rare few instances. But Alcoholics Anonymous has helped. What is this power that AA possesses? This curative power? I don't know what it is. I suppose the doctor might say, this is a psychosomatic medicine. I suppose the psychiatrist might say, this is benevolent interpersonal relations. I suppose others would say, this is group psychotherapy. To me, it is God. And if you ask me, what a beautiful, powerful ending just with those three words, five words. That's a psychic change. That's a complete shift around of looking at the world in a new pair of glasses. So we'll end on that, and I'm going to open it up to you guys. Thanks so much.